Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, a podcast dedicated to speaking to authors about their most recently published work. My name is Matthew Long, and I will be your host here at the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network for this most recent installment. The Second Formation of Islamic Law is a new contribution to the study of Islam, more specifically to the history of Islamic law and its development. Guy Barak, Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies librarian at New York University, explores the Ottoman adoption of one branch of the Hanafi legal tradition as the official school or madhab of the dynasty. The period of time in which this process occurred was during the 15th and 18th centuries, and Barak focuses on the lands of Greater Syria. What Barak seeks to illustrate is that through the adoption of an official school of law, the Ottoman hierarchy played a significant role in how the school of law was shaped. Examples Barak provides to demonstrate this phenomenon are the institutionalization of the position of mufti, the formalization of genealogical literature or tabakat, and the canonization process of books essential to the school. In addition to examining the propagators of official Ottoman positions, Barak also examines how scholars not part of the Ottoman mainstream school functioned and responded to these many changes. Overall, this work represents an important contribution to the study of Islam, the history of Islamic law, and Ottoman studies.
Hello, and welcome to the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network. This is your host, Matthew Long, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Guy Barak, about his book, The Second Formation of Islamic Law. How are you doing today, Guy?
I'm good, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, the pleasure is ours. I'm doing very well, and we're looking forward to speaking with you about your book. However, before we get started, would you be so kind to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, maybe a little bit about your academic history?
I'm currently the Middle Eastern Islamic Studies librarian at NYU's Elmer Holmes Bobbs Library. And before coming to NYU, or before I became a librarian, I did my PhD at NYU. And one of the reasons why I became a librarian at NYU is because I wanted to stay in New York and at NYU. I did my PhD in Ottoman history, or that's what I thought I was doing. But as I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to discuss later, it became very different. And now I feel comfortable in Ottoman studies, but I'm becoming more and more an Islamic studies person. And maybe I could say more about this transition later. And before that, I did my undergraduate studies at Tel Aviv University, where I was trained as an Ottomanist, but I also had strong interest in Islamic medieval history. And I think that my interest in medieval history is strongly reflected in my work.
Okay. So let's just jump right in. So what drew you to, you know, this topic, and how did you actually get started in, you know, writing this book?
So when I came to NYU to work on the dissertation that eventually ended up being the basis on which I wrote the book, I wanted to write about those jurists who were not members of the Hanafi school of law, that is the official school of law that the Ottomans ended up adopting. And for a while, this was what I wanted to do. But as I started looking at the materials, I realized that I really don't know anything about the Hanafis or the followers of the school that at the time I thought was well studied. And that led me to this project that was about those jurists that were affiliated with the state and what it meant to be affiliated with the Ottoman state in the 16th and 17th century. I started primarily, I was interested in the history of those jurists in the Arab provinces of the empire, especially in Syria. But then as the project evolved, it became a much more imperial project in scope, in the sense that Istanbul and the central lands of the empire are much more present in the project than what I had originally expected.
And I guess at this point, what I'd like to do is just kind of turn it over to you to kind of just start leading us through, you know, what it is that, you know, a little bit more about what you were looking at, and then kind of, you know, how the sort of things that you were looking at to explore, you know, your thesis.
Yeah, so I'll just start before I get to the content of the book. I'll say that the reason why the book is framed the way it is because I got an invitation from a friend of mine, Jonathan Brown, from Georgetown, to write an entry for an encyclopedia that he's editing on the history of the Islamic school of law. And at the time, I didn't think of what I was doing as a history of a school of law or a history of schools of law in general. And because of this entry, I suddenly realized that this is the framework for the book. So the book is, as I said, an attempt to explain what it meant or what it means for a state to officially adopt the school of law. For our listeners or for your listeners who are not familiar with Islamic legal history or not as familiar with Islamic legal history, I'll say that my basic argument is that when we look at the Ottoman period and more generally at the post-Mongol period, we see a very different kind of relationship between the state or the dynasty and the jurist. And we see a very different forms of patronage. And I think that this is the reason, this is basically the reason why I call the book The Second Formation. And part of this second formation is the adoption of an official school of law in the sense, and by adoption, what I think this adoption meant was a serious intervention on behalf of the ruling dynasty in shaping the doctrine and the structure of the school. And in this sense, it's very different from other forms of patronage that were basically reflected in employment, salaries, and affiliation with the court. Here we see a very different project institutionally and doctrinally.
And then kind of as you start to begin showing examples of this intervention, as you said, I think that's kind of what's going on in the chapters throughout your book, is that at least in my opinion, the first three chapters of the book are definitely examples of those interventions occurring, correct?
Yeah. So the first chapter, of the book looks at this issue of appointing muftis, that is appointing jurists that issued legal opinions before the Ottomans. By and large, muftis were not, or the institution of the mufti was not a position. Everyone who was granted a permission to issue fatwas and to teach law was considered a mufti. Under the Ottoman, we see a very interesting institutional transformation where the mufti becomes an official position, and therefore muftis could be fired or removed from office. And this is something that is very, very rare in pre-Ottoman times. I argue, and here I rely on jurists from the 17th and the 18th century who opposed this institutional transformation, that the appointment of mufti is more than just an attempt to regulate or perhaps systematize a legal system, but there is a doctrinal dimension to it too, and the doctrinal dimension is the attempt to regulate the content and the structure of the school itself, including its doctrines.
Mm-hmm. And so then you also kind of during that chapter, you specifically highlight a few examples of that as well with at least one particular individual.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting one of the more interesting jurists in this debate about this institutional transformation is a jurist from Damascus who was not appointed by the state, or to be more precise, was appointed for a very brief, he was appointed briefly, but then most of his career he was an independent or non-appointed jurist. And he openly says that what the Ottomans are doing is an attempt to basically regulate the doctrines of the school. And that was, if I have to point at a single most important source in this book, this treatise was a very illuminating a very illuminating text for me, because it really helped me understand what was at stake. And it was interesting to see that observers at the time understood that that was what, that this this was that this is what was at stake.
And just for our listeners, the treatise you were you're referring to is
Basically it's part of a debate about the practice of appointing muftis, and the jurist who wrote it is Abderrani Al-Nabulsi, a very prolific and very important jurist and mystic, and perhaps one of the better studied figures in 17th century Ottoman, definitely Syrian intellectual history. And this is one of the treatises, one of, I don't know if how well known this treatise is, but it exists in several copies. And that was, and he wrote about basically everything, starting from agriculture to mysticism to Islamic law. And this is one of the most interesting treatises I read for this project.
Okay. So muftis and their appointment becomes one of the interventions, as you had kind of said earlier. Is there anything else from this section that we should be taking away that the listeners should know about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the muftis in general are part of a much broader development that is the rise of religious and legal establishments. And one could say, or I definitely would, that the rise of religious and legal establishments is one of the most important and interesting legacies of the Ottoman period in the Ottoman and the post-Ottoman Middle East. And if you want to look at it from a broader perspective, so it's one of the more interesting legacies of the post-Mongol period more generally. And the muftis are just one understudied and I think very important element in this development of a hierarchy. And in a sense, the mufti or the institutional transformation that the institution of the mufti undergoes in this period captures the broader transformation that that the let's say that the evolution or development of religious establishment is all about, and it is more than a social or an institutional practice. It is a doctrinal it's a doctrinal project,
and something not seen prior to this period, really.
Not really.
Okay, and I should add for our listeners that when you do, you know, get a chance to read this work, that you provide a very, I thought, a very helpful introduction to, you know, to the muftis. And it's actually, that's what the segment is called, a very brief introduction. But I thought it was very, very helpful, even for someone, you know, versed in the field, that it does provide a little bit of more insight into the position and what it is, what it's becoming or what it becomes during, you know, this transitionary period.
Right.
Then in the subsequent two chapters that you follow up after this section are about another intervention, one intervention, but taken from two different perspectives. And would you go ahead and start you know, leading us through this portion of the work?
The second part is, or the next two chapters, are basically related to the rise of religious and legal establishment. And one of the things I was interested in is how these jurists who were affiliated with the legal establishment or learned hierarchy understood their own history and their own past within the tradition of the Hanafi school and more generally within Islamic history. And one of the ways of doing it was by writing those very interesting genealogies that lead basically from the prophet through the founder or the eponymous founder of the school, Abu Hanifa, to the learned hierarchy, the Ottoman learned hierarchy. And one of the things I'm trying to show is that these genealogies had very concrete implications, and they were intended to serve very practical purposes, one of which is to distinguish jurists that were affiliated with the learned hierarchy from other jurists who were followers of the Hanafi school but were not followers of this particular branch. And it was also, and these genealogies were also used as reference works to establish what the major doctrinal works and what were the most important arguments that followers of the, or that members of the learned hierarchy, the Ottoman learned hierarchy, should follow. But we also see, and that's basically what I look at in my third chapter, that there were responses to this attempt by jurists from the Arab provinces, and that the responses were quite diverse. One of them is basically an attempt to produce an alternative Hanafi genealogy that by and large excludes the Ottoman learned hierarchy and its branch within the Hanafi school. And the other project, which was commissioned by the Ottoman Sultan, but it was written by a jurist from the Arab land, is an attempt to come up with a more comprehensive work that will reconcile or bring together both branches or multiple branches within the Hanafi school. And the author identifies, or he knows or he understands the work as an attempt to produce a comprehensive survey of all the branches. But these developments are obviously related, and they are in dialogue with each other.
Mm-hmm. And this this genre does have a name, rather important name as well. What's the name of this genre?
The genre is known as tabakat, which means generations or layers, and it has a very long history in Islamic historiography or Islamic history writing. For some reason, the tabakat works from the Ottoman period have not been well studied or have not been systematically studied, whereas tabakat from earlier periods received much more attention. I just mentioned Kevin Jake's extremely influential, or at least I thought it was very important to me in my understanding of the genre and how to approach it. So I just mentioned Kevin Jake's work that was really important for this project. But there are really numerous studies of this genre. I'll just say that the genre is not only about, covers all kinds of religious sciences. So you can have the generation of Sufis, the generations of jurists, the generations of hadith transmitters. It's basically a way of documenting the transmission of knowledge, of religious knowledge, from the prophet to the author's times.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. you know, you spent a lot of time really talking about the two works from the third section and their purposes, and you did the same also with the second chapter. But were there other reasons that the I believe that you chose at least three different works or four? Excuse me, four different works. Did you have specific motivations for those four particular works?
Well, that's basically the four works I found. But I was interested in the fact that the Ottoman Tabakat project was an ongoing project, and if the earliest is from the second half of the 16th century, the latest I was able to find was from the early 18th century, and I was interested in disconnect in understanding why people thought they had to expand this project and why they weren't happy, or they thought that they had to reassert their claims over a very long period of time. And I think that each of these works is, on the one hand, there are clear continuities, but there are also some very interesting differences in the way they're organized, in the way they address more recent or current events. I think that the latest, for example, I link the latest to an interesting crisis that takes place in the first decade of the 18th century, where it's a well-known crisis in Ottoman history, where the Mufti is removed from office and eventually executed, and it is a very traumatic moment. And I think that the last work is related to this crisis, and it is an attempt to show that despite everything, we are still part of the same. We are still part of the learned hierarchy, and we are still affiliated with the learned, with the ruling dynasty. So there is an interesting interplay, or the issue of crisis is a major issue in these two chapters.
Okay. All right. Before we move on, is there anything else that the listeners should know about from these two sections?
Maybe I should say that the issue of crisis is something that I learned, or I got thinking about this issue of crisis in the production of this genre, again, from Kevin Jake's work. So for our listeners who are not familiar with Kevin's work, Kevin Jakes looked at the 15th century or an early 15th century Tabakat work from the Mamluk period, and he links the production of this work to an ongoing sense of crisis or authoritative crisis in the 14th and the 15th century. And this, so I try to understand what is this sense, or what kind of crisis the jurists in the period I was studying, what kind of crisis they were experiencing. And it seemed to me that the conquest and this encounter between different traditions created a sense of anxiety or authoritative crisis. And this crisis led them to produce those works. And in this sense, the works are gives us the opportunity to have a better sense of the of this sense, this very interesting sense of anxiety that we usually don't get from other sources.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So if we can, would you like to go ahead and move forward to the next section?
Yeah. So the fourth chapter sort of builds on the first two. And it is closely related to this issue of genealogies, and the genealogies as an attempt to canonize certain arguments and certain doctrines within the Hanafi school. And the fourth chapter looks at canonization practices, and particularly the formation of what I call an imperial jurisprudential canon over the course of the 15th, 16th, and 17th century. And I look at how books, legal texts, became part of the canon. And by becoming part of the canon, it meant that a book was circulated throughout the empire among members of the Ottoman learned hierarchy, and it was used in their rulings and in their writings. So I was interested in this formation of perhaps this collective identity through canon or through the formation of a canon. And this is basically what I look at on I look at in the fourth chapter, but here again, I look at different canonization practices and how different jurists, including jurists that were not affiliated with the learned hierarchy, how they understood canonization of texts and how they developed their own sense of canon. The main difference between these two very broad groups of jurists is that that members of the Ottoman learned hierarchy were willing to accept the intervention of the state and the ruling sultan, in the canonization of text. Early in the 16th century, it is the sultan itself, that canonizes text. That is, he issues edicts where he specifies what text can or should be read. Later are members of the learned hierarchy, but members of the learned hierarchy drew their authority, to a large extent at least, from their appointment, and drew their authority from the appointment by the sultan. So in a sense, they are an extension of the sultan in this canonization project. Jurists from the Arab lands, that is, jurists that were not affiliated with the learned hierarchy, still followed older practices, and they believed that a book get canonized based on consensus or the agreement of leading authorities or leading jurists who come gradually to agree on the importance of a certain work.
At one point, you mentioned how the Sultan could become involved in the canonization process, was involved in the canonization process of what can or should be used. So a quick follow-up question: during these times, were there, did the levels of restrictiveness or application of that become more harsh or more liberal? I guess what I'm really trying to ask is, were there moments where the canonization was you should, but you can still use other works versus you must use these?
Yeah.
Were there any periods of fluctuation like that?
It's actually a very interesting, it's a great question. And it touches on the comparison between what we see in the Ottoman Empire and what we see in Europe at the time. So we don't have, we don't have censorship in the Ottoman Empire in the sense that we don't have an institution that censors books. And one of the interesting things is that the Ottomans never banned other books. And we see, if we look at the empire's textual landscape, we see books that were part of the imperial canon and circulating sometimes in the same library and by the same people, circulating with books that were never, that were not officially canonized. And this makes the Ottoman story very, very interesting. And, but it also shows the power of the learned hierarchy as a canonizing, environment or as a canonizing institution. And it was based on some sense of establishment consciousness that the canon emerged. But at the same time, there were many texts And many of these texts made it to Istanbul, and many of these texts are today in various libraries in Istanbul that were never part of the canon, but still circulated.
And then one additional follow-up to that, because so much of your work is focused on the Hanafi school, and when you had just said that there was still accessibility to a great number of works that were not part of the canon, did that also apply to books not even within the school itself, that, you know, for our listeners, you know, maybe Maliki scholars, Maliki jurists, and more probably more prominently Shafi'i jurists, would their works been equally accessible?
Yeah, they were. I mean, especially throughout the Arab provinces, where there was a strong presence of Shafi'is and Malikis, and to a much lesser extent Hanbalis. So, and these jurists kept writing, and many of them remained quite influential. So we have this part that I barely touch on in this book, but I can mention a recent, very interesting work that actually looks at these jurists. It's Ahmed Fikri Ibrahim's Pragmatism in Islamic Law. He looks, he focuses on those, on the non-Hanafi jurists. And he shows that many of these authorities were still around. And they also had a very interesting relationship with the learned hierarchy. So there is much more than what I cover in this book.
Okay. Wonderful. Any further comments before we move forward?
Pretty much it.
Okay. And then transitioning to the final chapter before you make your concluding remarks, you talk about plurality a little bit. Can you go ahead and start leading us through that portion?
Yeah. For a while, I was very hesitant about the fourth chapter. I didn't know if I should write it. I mean, it seemed that it wasn't very necessary. I mean, it's a chapter that parts of it are in the dissertation, but it didn't seem very important. I thought that it should be part of a separate project. But then I realized that I felt that I had to say something about how non-jurists or broader circles in Ottoman society experienced this diversity between different jurists and different legal authorities and different legal traditions. And so the fifth chapter basically looks at how different people, some were members of the Ottoman ruling elite, some were commoners, and made use of these multiple authorities for different practices. And that obviously, or as you mentioned, it raises questions about the nature of the nature of the legal administration of the empire, and how do you explain, or how should we understand the existence of multiple authorities, and how do we understand the nature of the learned hierarchy within this very complex landscape?
Can you go ahead and continue?
So for this reason, and here muftis are very useful, because muftis issued their legal opinions, and the legal opinions were connected or collected in collections of legal rulings. So what I did, I basically looked at how different people made use of the different muftis, and how they. So I looked at cases where different groups bring the same case to different muftis, and then I sort of trace how these different rulings were used in the Ottoman legal system. It's very clear that the state appointed muftis, or the officially appointed muftis, were considered more like authoritative in the Ottoman legal system. That doesn't mean that rulings by non-appointed muftis were never brought to court, but at least the way the legal procedure is documented, and that's the sources I had, it's very clear that the Ottoman legal system supported the officially appointed muftis. But it's also very interesting to see how people brought rulings and court resolutions issued by the imperial legal system to other muftis who were not appointed. So it goes in multiple directions. And what I basically wanted to do in the book, or in this chapter, is to show that this is not just a doctrinal, almost academic debate between jurists, but it's something that really touched on the lives of many individuals across the empire.
Okay. Any further remarks to add to that then?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. And then just tying everything together, you offer some concluding notes to kind of tie everything together. Could you go ahead and lead us through what that is?
Yeah, so the conclusion is basically an attempt to take the book, or the body of the book, that is essentially a very Ottoman or Ottomanist book, and to situate it in a broader context, in the context of the post-Mongol Islamic East. And I think that the conclusion sort of reflects the way my understanding of the project evolved. I started as an Ottomanist, and I was trained as an Ottomanist. Most of my sources are in Ottoman, Turkish, and Arabic, are situated in certain libraries in Istanbul and elsewhere. And the historiographical debates I participate in, or I participated in, were primarily Ottomanist. But the conclusion tries to situate the book in a much broader context, and to take the Ottoman story and turn it into a case study, and to show that that what we see in the Ottoman case is just it's an interesting example of a much more interesting development that we see basically from the 14th or the 15th century from India to the Balkans. And it's also an attempt to write the period I'm interested in into the grand narratives of Islamic law, and basically the most narratives of Islamic law, of the grand narratives of Islamic legal history. My impression was that they didn't reflect the complexity and the innovation of those centuries. Most of them ended, for various reasons, ended in the 15th century. Then they said a short chapter on the Ottoman period, and then they sort of get interested again in Islamic legal history in the 19th and the 20th century. And what I wanted to do is really look at those short chapters and basically to reorganize, or to offer a new periodization of Islamic legal history, and to argue that many of the things that we see in the 19th century stem from much earlier development. Some of these developments can be traced back to the late 15th century. And in a sense, I hope that the book offers new ways to think about this, about this time period, basically from the 15th century to the present.
I think the book is wonderful. I think that you have made significant contributions. It's definitely very eye-opening, not being familiar with the topic, but very clear. you know, well-written and very explanatory when it comes to all the different elements that you're bringing together here.
Thanks.
We've taken up a lot of your time to discuss this work, but before we let you go for the day, are there any upcoming projects that you're working on that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, so now I'm currently working on the second part of this book, which basically looks at the history of dynastic law or canon, a concept that I touch on briefly in the book. And the book basically looks at the history of this concept, again, from the 14th century to the 20th century and maybe even to the present. And basically what I try to do in the book is I try to explain why this concept deserves much more attention than what we have, including myself, paid to it, and to show that why this concept was so important for understanding the developments that I describe in this book. The second book, or the new book, basically grows out of my realization that I sort of missed the main story in the first book. I mean, when I wrote this book, I thought that the main story was the rise of an official school of law. Now I really understand, or at least I strongly believe that the main story is the story of the dynastic, the legal claims that dynasties, including the Ottomans, were making in the post-Mongol period. One of the manifestations of these claims is the intervention in other legal discourses, including Islamic law, but it doesn't have to be, it's not exclusively a Muslim or an Islamic story. I mean, I think we can find similar dynamics with other legal discourses, and it doesn't have to be exclusively a Sunni story, because we see similar developments in the Shia world. So this is basically what the new project is about.
Well, that sounds wonderful. We look forward to seeing that in the future, then. Well, like I said, we have taken up a lot of your time today. I really want to thank you for taking this time to share your work, share information about the book with all of our listeners, and want to encourage our listeners to go out there and to pick up a copy and to explore it themselves. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And you have a good day.
You too.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for joining us as we spoke with Guy Burek about his book, The Second Formation of Islamic Law. Please be sure to come back to the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network in a few weeks for a new podcast, as well as check out some of our previous podcasts. Also, feel free to check out one of the many other channels we have here at the New Books Network. Thank you very much for joining us.